This is Wendy Bauer, returning with the Decatur Herald and Review, dated November 2nd, 2015. We continue now with the obituaries. Mary Margaret Rigdon, Decatur. Mary Margaret Rigdon, 83, now of Mason City, Iowa, passed away on Friday, October 30th, 2015, at Mercy Hospital, Mason City, Iowa. A funeral mass in Mary's honor will be held at 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, November 3rd, 2015, at Epiphany Parish, St. Joseph's Catholic Church, 302 5th Street Southeast, Mason City. Interment will be in Memorial Park Cemetery following the service. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. Monday, November 2nd, at Hogan Bremer Moore Colonial Chapel, 126 3rd Street Northeast, Mason City, with a rosary at 6:30 p.m. and a scriptural wake service to follow. Those wishing to give a memorial in her memory may want to consider the St. Joseph Baby Pantry, Epiphany Parish. Mary was the director of the Baby Pantry for many years. It remained a charity close to her heart. Carol Ann Logeman, Decatur. Carol Ann Logeman, 70, of Decatur, passed away Sunday, November 1, 2015, at Carl Foundation Hospital in Urbana. Memorial services to celebrate Carol's life will be at 11 a.m. Wednesday, November 4th, at Holy Cross Lutheran Church, 3778 North Water Street, Decatur, Illinois. In lieu of flowers, the family suggests memorials to Holy Cross Lutheran Church in Decatur. And funerals listed as pending for Monday, November 2nd, 2015. William Anderson, 71, of Decatur, who died Saturday, October 31st, 2015, Brintlinger and Earl Funeral Homes in Decatur. Rella W. Four, 84, of Shelbyville, who died Saturday, October 31st, 2015, Lockhart Green Funeral Home in Shelbyville. Alice Kaiser, 95, of Strasburg, died Sunday, November 1st, 2015, Howe and Yaki Funeral Home, Shelbyville. And Betty Palmer, 80, of Decatur, died Sunday, November 1st, 2015, Walker Funeral Service and Chapel. And from the opinion page, we have a columnist, Eugene Robinson. Debate may have sealed Bush's fate. Jeb Bush deserves headlines from Wednesday's anarchic GOP debate, but not the good kind. Something like, is Bush finished? The evening in Boulder, Colorado will be remembered for interruptions, non sequiturs, mangled facts, and general chaos. But the most significant impact may have been to dramatically lengthen the odds that Bush, the dutiful Zion, will follow his father and brother into the White House. The key moment came fairly early in the debate when Senator Marco Rubio of Florida considered Bush's biggest rival for consolidating the support of the GOP establishment was asked about having missed so many Senate votes while out on the campaign trail. Rubio responded by attacking the bias that exists in the American media today, claiming there is a double standard and that Republicans are judged more harshly than Democrats. Bush attacked. I'm a constituent of the senator, he said, and I helped him, and I expected that he would do constituent service, which means that he shows up to work. In his characteristic, look here, old boy, sort of way, Bush told Rubio he should either perform his duties or just resign and let someone else take the job. Rubio shot back that Bush never complained about all the votes missed in 2008 by John McCain, to whose campaign Bush had compared his own. Then Rubio gave his one-time mentor the back of his hand. The only reason you're doing it now is because we are running for the same position, and someone has convinced you that attacking me is going to help you. The crowd cheered. Bush made no retort. Rubio had made him appear, in Churchill's memorable phrase, a sheep in sheep's clothing. Bush had spent the past week trying to assure donors and supporters that he has the drive, desire, and political skill to fight with no holds barred for the nomination. Wednesday's performance was woefully unconvincing. Rubio, by contrast, had his best outing thus far. He was sharp and aggressive throughout, deflecting any question he didn't want to answer with a fresh round of media bashing. If I were a would-be Republican kingmaker of the establishment persuasion, I'd invite Rubio for lunch and remind Bush of his recent declaration that there are really cool things I could do other than sit around, be miserable, listening to people demonize me and me feeling compelled to demonize them. Senator Ted Cruz of Texas was at the top of his game, showing he can be more clever and eloquent than Rubio in attacking perceived, or imagined, media bias. "This is not a cage match," he pronounced. "And you look at the questions. Donald Trump, are you a comic book villain? Ben Carson, can you do math? John Kasich, will you insult two people over here? Marco Rubio, why don't you resign? Jeb Bush, why have your numbers fallen? How about talking with the substantive issues the people care about?" That peroration drew one of the night's biggest ovations, but it came in response to a question about Cruz's position on the budget deal between President Obama and outgoing House Speaker John Boehner. Somehow, this doesn't fit Cruz's definition of substance. The battle among Rubio, Cruz, and Bush was amusing, but it was for primacy among also-rans. The two leaders, billionaire Donald Trump and Dr. Ben Carson, went unscathed, generally managing to stay out of the fray. Trump was brassy, Carson was serene. Neither said or did anything to dissuade their legions of followers. When pressed on glaring contradictions, they simply denied saying or proposing things they said and proposed. All the politicians are still playing second fiddle to a real estate mogul and a retired neurosurgeon who somehow have stolen the Republican Party. And a column from the opinion page by Jonah Goldberg. Liberals play their own race card. Here's something you may not know. Dr. Ben Carson is black. Of course, I'm being a little cute here. The only way you wouldn't know he's black is if you were blind and only listened to the news. For instance, Tuesday on MSNBC's Morning Joe, a program that often serves as a kind of artisanal boutique of inside the Beltway conventional wisdom, host Joe Scarborough expressed his consternation over Carson's popularity. "I just don't get it," Scarborough said more than once. Remarking on some Carson ad he didn't like, Scarborough said, "This guy is up 20 points in Iowa? It's baffling." Co-host Mika Brzezinski kept saying, "I just don't get the Ben Carson," before trailing off into an inarticulate exasperation. Washington Post columnist Eugene Robinson took a plausible stab at why Carson is popular. "They like him. They like him," he repeated, referring to conservatives in Iowa and elsewhere who admire Carson's dignified and soft-spoken demeanor. True enough, Carson has the highest favorables of any candidate in the GOP field. But what's remarkable is that at no point in this conversation did anyone call attention to the fact that Carson is an African American. Indeed, most analysis of Carson's popularity from pundits focuses on his likable personality and his sincere Christian faith. But it's intriguingly rare to hear people talk about the fact that he's black. One could argue, even more authentically, African American than Barack Obama, given that Obama's mother was white, and he was raised in part by his white grandparents. In his autobiography, Obama writes at length about how he grew up outside the traditional African-American experience in Hawaii and in Indonesia, and how he consciously chose to adopt a black identity when he was in college. Meanwhile, Carson grew up in Detroit, the son of a very poor, very hard-working single mother. His tale of rising from poverty to becoming the head of pediatric neurosurgery at Johns Hopkins Hospital is one of the most inspiring rags-to-riches stories of the last half century. He was a towering figure in the black community in Baltimore and nationally, at least until he became a Republican politician. And that probably explains why his race seems to be such a non-issue for the media. The New York Times is even reluctant to refer to him as a doctor. The Federalist reports that Jill Biden, who has a doctorate in education, is three times more likely to be referred to as doctor in the Times as brain surgeon Carson. If the Times did that to a black Democrat, charges of racism would be thick in the air. How strange it must be for people who comfort themselves with the slander that the GOP is a cult of organized racial hatred, that the most popular politician among conservatives is a black man. Better to ignore the elephant in the room than account for such an inconvenient fact. The race card is just too valuable politically and psychologically for liberals who need to believe that their political opponents are evil. Carson's popularity isn't solely derived from his race, but it is a factor. The vast majority of conservatives resent the fact that Democrats glibly and shamelessly accuse Republicans of bigotry simply because they disagree with liberal policies, which most conservatives believe hurt minorities. Yet conservatives also refuse to adopt those liberal policies just to prove they aren't bigots. Carson, not to mention Carly Fiorina and Hispanics Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio, demonstrates that there's no inherent contradiction between being a minority or a woman and supporting conservative principles. And that fact is just too terrible for some liberals to contemplate. And from the At Work page, tips for making wise health benefit choices. If you're young and healthy, picking a health insurance policy with the lowest monthly premium may seem like the way to go. But a lower premium often means signing up for a high deductible or health care services you must pay for before insurance kicks in, and deductibles are rising. According to the latest annual study by the Kaiser Family Foundation, in 2015, single coverage workplace plans had an average deductible of $1,318, up 8% from the year before. A decade ago, the average was just $584. Not all plans have a deductible, but 81% of single coverage plans did in 2015. People should make sure they can afford the costs beyond the premium, said Gary Claxton, lead author of the Kaiser study and a vice president at the foundation. With open enrollment occurring soon at many companies, here's what to consider as you select your health care benefits next year. Go in-network. The cost of seeing a doctor typically is cheaper if you stick to your plan's list of preferred providers. So even if you have a high deductible, you'll save by staying in-network. If you already have a doctor, double-check that he or she will remain in-network next year. Networks can change, said Katie Votava, president and founder of GoodCare.com, a health insurance consulting firm. Keep in mind, too, that under the Affordable Care Act, certain preventative health care services, such as an annual wellness screening, vaccinations, and FDA-approved contraceptives, are free. Look at the list of preventative visits that are covered and make sure you take advantage of those services, Votava said. Check your meds. See how the cost of any medicine you regularly take will be covered. A low premium policy can end up being more expensive in the long run if the benefits for your prescription drugs are puny, Votava said. To check, go to the insurer's website or call the insurer's customer service center. Contribute to an HSA. With some high deductible health plans, you can open a health savings account, which offers key tax benefits. For one, contributions to HSAs are tax deductible, and if you use the savings for qualified medical expenses, withdrawals are tax free. To qualify for an HSA in 2016, a single policy must have a minimum deductible of $1,300. For family plans, the minimum is $2,600. Your employer may contribute toward your HSA, but you can also put money in the account up to a combined total of $3,350 for single policies next year, or $6,750 for family plans. People who turn 55 or older in 2016 can contribute another $1,000. What if you leave your job or change insurance plans? The HSA stays with you and you can continue to use your savings for medical expenses. Contributing to an HSA when you're young and don't have big health care needs could be a smart move. Healthcare costs continue to shift to the employee, so as much as you can, sock money away in an HSA now, said Nate Purpura, Vice President of Consumer Affairs at eHealth.com, an online health insurance broker. Know the out-of-pocket max. Finally, keep in mind that although health insurance kicks in after you reach the deductible, you will have to cover co-payments or co-insurance for medical services, up to a maximum out-of-pocket amount per year. Your chances of hitting that maximum, which can be more than $6,000 for single coverage, are probably low, but it's still a good idea to think of how you might come up with the cash in case you have a medical emergency. Young people shouldn't just think about what happened to them last year, because for most of them, they didn't even need insurance, Claxton said. You have to consider, what if I get sick? And from Decatur, by Huey Freeman, Herald and Review staff writer, children pick up prizes in cleanup. It pays to work, even labor of the most gritty variety. That was the lesson several children learned after picking up trash near their homes on a regular basis during October. Diamante Barnett and his sister Iris Johnson won bicycles for collecting the most litter on the busiest street in a contest sponsored by Beautify Decatur and the Coalition of Neighborhood Organizations. An 8-year-old second grader at Harris School, Diamante said he picked up paper and bottles, glass and plastic several times a week on Jasper Street between Leafland Avenue and Condit Street. When asked why he received a brand new bicycle Saturday morning, he replied, "Because I did hard work." Not that he badly needed a new bicycle. In fact, he already has enough to start his own bike shop. "Now I have 5 bicycles," said Diamante, whose activities include playing basketball at the Boys and Girls Club and JFL football. Sue Lawson, Kono president, said that 2/3 of the young people who signed up for the contest during a September 26th street festival followed through, while some enlisted in the cleanup cause afterward. "For the first time, it was a great success," Lawson said. Susan Avery, Beautify Decatur co-chair, expressed appreciation to all the children who participated during the award ceremony at Torrance Park Pavilion Saturday morning. "We hope you keep cleaning up the neighborhoods," she said, adding that they should tell their parents not to litter. 44 children participated, 22 teams of 2 each. Some were supervised by adults, such as Ray Allen, grandfather of the first place winners. Judges went out to each block to evaluate the effectiveness of the workers. Decatur police officers took part in the judging. 2 officers, Cody Rose and Scott Gilman, were on hand at the pavilion to pass out candy to trick-or-treaters who appeared during and after the ceremony. Decatur Memorial Hospital provided the funding for the prizes, as well as the incentive money for the sign-ups at the street festival 5 weeks earlier. 4 children received Walmart gift cards for winning in other categories. "What was the nastiest thing you had to pick up?" Lawson asked the 2 girls who cleaned up the 1100 block of North Jordan Street. "Dirty diapers," Davy Barbie replied. She and her sister, Daviana, won in the category of Most Improved Block. The winners for the cleanest block in an area that was already fairly clean, Zamara Clemens and his sister, Azion Maddox, who toiled on the 2200 block of South Franzi Drive. The neighborhoods in the cleanup effort included Old King's Orchard, GM Square, Fans Field, Torrance West End, and South Shores. And from Decatur, Tony Reed, CAT layoffs begin hitting home. Caterpillar Inc. has begun issuing pink slips to Decatur workers. It's the arrival of the grim news the city has been bracing itself for since Caterpillar warned in September that 5,000 salaried posts will be cut company-wide by the end of 2015. And Caterpillar also said up to 10,000 jobs might be history by 2018. Company spokeswoman Rachel Potts said, "Yes, some notifications are occurring in Decatur, but we're not breaking out the impact by location at this time." Caterpillar does not usually comment on exactly how many jobs are being eliminated at particular locations. But local news reporting in its home base of Peoria outlined similar layoff notices affecting employees there. One office worker at Caterpillar's Global Information Services division in Mossville told Journal Star in Peoria that 1,000 workers had been fired Wednesday. Caterpillar has told Wall Street it has now upped the cash set aside for layoffs from $250 million to $800 million. And the actual numbers of white-collar workers let go could have been even higher, but for a voluntary retirement package which more than 2,000 employees have accepted. Quoted recently, Brad Halverson, Caterpillar's chief financial officer, said some 2,100 workers, half of them in the Peoria area, have taken the packages. As with layoff numbers, the company did not break down the acceptance numbers for Decatur and other major Caterpillar plants. Halverson said the acceptance rate overall meant about 50% of those offered the deal had taken it. Spokeswoman Potts confirmed Halverson's quoted comments. Said another way, if we didn't offer the voluntary program, the number of involuntary reductions would be far more, she said Wednesday. But that still leaves a long way to go. Caterpillar is looking to salvage its sagging bottom line by saving $1.5 billion a year. The company says achieving that target means 20 unidentified facilities have been earmarked either for closure or consolidation by 2018. There is no word yet on Decatur's fate, but its status as the sole source for making the world's biggest dump trucks favored by miners would appear to be a big plus in its favor. Caterpillar has invested millions of dollars into the plant, dating back to the days when sales were booming. A few years ago, for example, Caterpillar would have needed one of those Decatur trucks to haul home its sales and revenues, which hit $66 billion in 2012. The 2016 sales and revenue numbers is predicted to be off that total by 30%, or some $20 billion. Caterpillar's Resource Industries division, which includes the Decatur-built trucks, has been leading the sales plunge. Now, what makes that decline tough is that most of that decline, nearly two-thirds of it, has been in resource industries, which is primarily mining, said Michael DeWalt, Caterpillar vice president in charge of the finance services division. And back in 2012, resource industries was without question our most profitable segment. That was before the bottom fell out of the commodities market and left Caterpillar facing 2016 as the fourth straight year of sales declines, something unprecedented in a 90-year company history that includes the Great Depression. DeWalt and Caterpillar's top management had spelled out the grim situation to industry analysts following the release of 2015 third quarter results that saw sales and revenues off 19% from the 2014 third quarter. Resource Industries swung to a $68 million quarterly loss, and its sales and revenues are predicted to be off another 10% in 2016. DeWalt said the only good news is that the bad news doesn't mean as much anymore because Resource Industries sales are already at the bottom of a mine shaft. I can tell you, 10% means a lot less today than 10% meant in 2012, he added. Caterpillar's chairman and CEO, Doug Oberhelman, said that the Wall Street analysts his company had been building more than 1,500 trucks a year for mining customers when sales peaked in 2012. Certainly in 2015, we'll be probably 80 or 90% below that, he said. Caterpillar says mining operations around the world are still humming along and has faith that mining demand will come back. But the company is surprised and frustrated by the ability of suddenly tight-fisted miners to keep old trucks and equipment running by extending service life and cannibalizing junk machines for parts to avoid buying new stuff. And that is one of the things that has kind of baffled us, Oberhelman said. Miners are doing what they need to do to reserve cash, lower expenses. We haven't seen that dramatic of an extension in the life cycles of machinery ever. Its back firmly pressed against the mine wall, Caterpillar says cost-cutting will lay its path out of the sales crisis. The company has already cut 35,000 workers in the last 3 years and shuttered or consolidated 10% of its production square footage. Now the global workforce of 109,000 braces for more rounds of job cuts, which Oberhelman describes as very painful to our people across the world, but necessary. And from Tim Kaine, the entertainment editor, The Economics of Changing Entertainment. Young and old fans collected baseball cards for in excess of a half century. A change in the hobby has some old-timers shaking their heads. But the result of those changes illuminates how much so many things have changed as we move into a digital age. Did you know Topps manufactures virtual baseball cards? The app is free, but Topps has earned thousands of dollars from fans who buy digital coins to afford digital baseball card packs. The app has a 5-star rating in the Apple Store. The twist in the hobby has its share of supporters, but also its share of detractors. Those troubled by the shift in location for purchases have the same concerns the rest of us have had at some point. Where are the books I read on my Kindle? Where are the songs I listened to on my iPod? Where is this game I'm playing? An extensive amount of our world has gone virtual. We've made the change so gradually that only time becomes a big deal for us is when something we never pictured as virtual suddenly presents itself to us, like baseball cards. For years, one of the most logical ways to deliver printed material to readers has been virtually. There are people now reading this on tablets or smartphones or looking at a full page on a big screen. Magazines and newspapers were later to the game than they should have been, but they've arrived and their customers are slowly switching from the physical to the virtual. There are dozens of boxes holding thousands of albums in my house. That same amount of music could be reduced to a stack of 100 DVDs or a portable hard drive of the correct size. My music hasn't fully made that conversion yet, which is one reason there are still dozens of boxes of albums in my house. But the change has come. Those vinyl records, however much anybody who loves albums and analog sound might argue, have become instant antiques, the latest version of 78 RPM discs or 8-track cartridges or wax cylinders. However, the advantage held by those forms of housing music sounds is that they were and are all physical. If someone tells you they have an album, they can physically show it to you. If someone has a Ryan Sandberg rookie card, they've got it under glass and can hold it while you look at it, or let you hold it. The tactile experience can make all the difference in the world for some collectors. This has been Wendy Bauer with the Decatur Herald and Review on November 2nd, 2015. I look forward to reading with you again soon. Thank you.